Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Sean Rabin. Born in Hobart, Tasmania, Sean Rabin has worked as a cook, script reader, copy editor, freelance journalist, and librarian. He's lived in Ireland, Italy, London, and New York, and now resides in Sydney, Australia. His debut novel, Wood Green, Giramondo, was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards 2017, and the Readings Prize for New Australian Fiction 2016 was also longlisted for the ALS Gold Medal. It was published in the UK by Dodo Inc. in 2016, and he left off, I think, the most important thing in his bio, which is he has a new book called The Good Captain, which is just, I think, fantastic. So, first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me on the program, Derek. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, let's talk about the new book. Just sort of give us a rundown, and then how it came to be, etc.
The Good Captain is a cat and mouse seafaring adventure, which follows a group of radical environmentalists who are trying to protect the remaining life in the ocean. It's set in the near future, a future that I thought was a long way away, and as I was writing it, it was quickly becoming a lot closer. And it's about this group who are sinking fishing trawlers in a bid to protect the last remaining life, and at the same time they've also making a bid to make a political statement on the land as well. I'll leave it at that, just to not make any spoilers.
So how did I don't know how to ask this. How did you how did you come to well, I guess I'll just ask it. You know, the political novels are very much out of favor these days. You know, we have Charles Dickens, we have Thomas Hardy, we have Stephen Crane, we have all sorts of great political novelists. Johnny Got His Gun, Dalton Trumbo, is one of the best anti-war novels ever written. We have these great political novels, and they seem to have fallen out of favor over the past 80-100 years. And, well, actually, do you want to go there, or would you rather talk about the plight of the oceans first? Let's go with the plight of the oceans first.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe I'll explain how I came to write the book, which was about 20 years ago. My wife and I were having a brief holiday in Greece, and we were living in London at the time. And we went to a little island that had no discos or no bars. We went there specifically just to be quiet, play Scrabble, read books, and just, you know, be relaxed. And so we had a lovely time. It was a very small island. And I went snorkeling one day, and I was just amazed. There was nothing. There was nothing in the ocean, in the water. There was just, and I grew up in Australia, so you can stand at the beach in Australia waiting for the waves to come in, and there are fish swimming between your legs. And so it's so abundant here. The marine life is so abundant that I was the contrast was so shocking that I just couldn't believe it. It was like a moonscape. And for there not to even be any plant life, or there not to be any crustaceans, or, you know, I was shocked, and I sort of went back to London just trying to figure this out, what had happened in the Mediterranean. And it's quite easy to figure out what happened. And then I, you know, this stayed with me, and then I just started reading about it. I encountered a documentary called The End of the Line, and I just kept on reading and reading nonfiction books about industrial fishing, just about the ocean. And I suppose... I wanted to, and then I became a father, and I thought, the prospect, how am I going to explain to my son when he asks me, Dad, where did all the fish go? I'm going to say, well, they were eaten. And then he's going to say, well, what did you do to stop it? And I just felt as though I had to do something, whether it's, you know, not everyone can be brave enough to join Sea Shepherd. And, you know, not everyone can do what they can do. And I thought, well, I can write. That's my career or ambition. And so I thought, well, I'm gonna write about this and try and communicate it to as many people as I can, because I would go to dinner parties and, you know, be served fish, and I'd sort of go, well, thank you for the meal, but I don't really want to eat this, and this is the reason why. And yeah, I got invited to a lot less dinner parties, but I was also amazed at how little people knew. There are so many books out there about the state of the ocean and the problems that it's facing, and yet they're so easy to ignore, because, you know, to read a nonfiction book, you have to, you know, show an active interest. You can't just, you know, casually, you don't usually just casually pick up a nonfiction book. And I thought, well, what's a way of communicating these issues in a different way? And I thought, well, fiction is a different way. You can sort of create an environment which is such an engaging story that people, even if they don't want to receive the information, they receive it simply by just being engaged with the story and taken along. And so, yeah, I also, you know, I also enjoy stories such as The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat or Dust Boot. And so they're stories, they're seafaring adventure stories about, you know, hunting U-boats or being in a U-boat during World War II. And I just thought they were so exciting, such exciting reads that the two ideas sort of melded together. And that's how I arrived at writing the book, I suppose. Yeah.
So I have a writer question, which is, how did you, without giving away spoilers, how did you develop the plot? Are you the sort of writer who plots out everything beforehand, or do you I heard a line the other day that perfectly describes how I write books, which is some famous writer said that basically for them, writing a book is like driving a car at night, that basically this writer could only see what was in the headlights. And that's pretty much it for me, that I only know, you know, what's the next 20 pages, and then beyond that, it's like, I'll worry about it when I get there. Or are you a tight plotter?
No, I think I'm the former, what you've described. I always know where the book is going to end or how it's going to end. I have the last scene in my mind as a place to aim for. But as far as knowing what's going to happen in the middle, is it's always the most pleasant surprise. Oh, my imagination came up with that. I don't know where it came from, but that's interesting. And sort of being sensitive to how your imagination or your intelligence, your intellect sort of takes you, and what it plucks out of the ether, and or what it bubbles up from your experience. I find that endlessly interesting. And part of the pleasure of writing is those wonderful surprises of imagination. So I didn't really, I think for The Good Captain, I wrote a lot and had to just refine it over quite a number of years. And that's how I sort of arrived at the essence of the book. I'm not a very good plotter. Plotting out things in advance.
So let's how did you face the question of the sort of modern fiction ethos of, if you want to send a message, use Western Union? Which I find offensive, and we can discuss why I find that offensive if you want. I mean, how did you, let's just be honest. There is a lot of political writing that I think is really crap and can be really preachy in a bad way. And the question is, how did you navigate? There's my question.
I think it was quite a difficult process. I had done an enormous amount of research, and I felt that was actually a harder task to achieve, the balance between writing a work of fiction and incorporating a lot of all this great information that I thought was really important. It's sort of finding that delicate balance between entertaining the reader but also informing them. And that took a long time. As far as being, as far as avoiding, say, being preachy or being dogmatic, well, I wasn't really trying to avoid it. I am preachy a bit and I am dogmatic about this issue because it's so important to me. And I'm so sort of uninterested in being of being gentle about it in some ways, because it makes me furious, and I was furious, and I, you know, it's sort of that idea of like an angry young man. Well, you know, as I've got older, I'm not sort of an angry young man anymore. I'm a furious old man. I'm just absolutely furious that this is happening on my watch. And so I wasn't really that interested in sort of making sure I didn't offend any, hurt anyone's sensitivities or opinions. I sort of actually wanted to say, this is happening. What are you going to do about it? What stand are you going to make? And that's sort of the issue of the book, is like, it's not about encouraging people to do what's in the book. It's about making them aware of the situation and then asking the question, well, these people have made, are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to save the last fish on the planet. Before we reach that point, what sacrifices are you as a reader or you as a person willing to make before we reach that point? And I find that interesting. I find that, I'm sure you do as well, Derek. I mean, it's a constant question of like, what is it going to take for you to make a stand? How much do you have to have before you think about something greater than your own self-gratification?
Well, I think that that takes us to, for me, I mean, writing is really difficult, and it is not particularly remunerative.
No.
unless your name's Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And but it seems to me that one of the points of writing is to help people to be better human beings. And, you know, I think about, I mean, a book that has always stuck with me is Lord Jim.
Joseph Conrad.
Just a brief synopsis of that is a person does something absolutely terrible. A good person does something terrible in a moment of weakness and spends the rest of his life attempting to atone for it. And it gives me chills to think about the lessons involved in there. That's what we do, is how do I live my life? I mean, isn't that what really novels are supposed to do for us? I mean, as well as, of course, you know, make us turn the pages and stay up until 4 a.m.
Hmm. I think there's a lot of discussion about novels being the ideal a medium by which to imagine climate change, and I think that's true. Novels have, there's been a lot of research into what part of the brain lights up when you read, and it's pretty much the part of the brain where that lights up when you experience anything. So the idea of reading is very close to experience. That's why we feel for characters when we read about them. That's why we're emotionally involved. That's why we might put down a book if it gets too scary, just to have a moment of take a pause. There's this strange magic or this strange reaction that we have where we know that we're engaging with just words and ink on the page, but we're actually feeling these emotions. And so I think, sorry, Derek, I've forgotten your question. What was it?
What is the point of a novel? What is
I think the novel can really work as a tool of empathy, and if we have to face a future where with mass extinction and with empty oceans, a book is a very safe environment with which to practice how to deal with that. And maybe if we encounter just an insight into how that might feel, then we might actually avoid that future by doing something about it. So I feel more so than television, more so than film, because there's sort of a passive engagement with that. But with fiction, if you're sort of engaged with the story and you come out of it afterwards and you put the book down, you might actually be a little bit changed, and it might actually resonate a little bit longer than cinema or TV. I had a friend who read The Good Captain recently, and she was quite cross with me because she said, "Oh, I can't look at plastic anymore the same way," and she was a little bit angry at me about it, and I thought, well, that's great. Actually, I made you sort of see the world a little bit differently, made you sort of think about something in a different way. And that's all I'm trying to achieve as an author, I think, is just to maybe give you an insight into, something else that's happening in the world besides what you already know.
Sorry if this is another kind of crap question, but
No.
I have to say that, reading this book was, let me just say that I don't know any environmentalists who have not at some point or another fantasized about sinking trawlers. And that is just tremendously satisfying to
Well, I'm glad.
And I'm thinking about, Gore Vidal had this kind of funny line or pretty funny line about, how most first novels are thinly veiled plots of revenge. And it's just this, that's one of the things I love about writing fiction is that, it's really just, in many ways, it's just sort of daydreaming.
Exactly. And when it comes to the idea of sinking trawlers, through my research, of course, I encountered Sea Shepherd, and they're incredibly brave people who get shot at and who, get rammed by other ships. I can't express how much I admire their courage. But they have, a philosophy of harm no humans, and I'm not passing judgment upon that philosophy. But sometimes I would get so frustrated with the constant awareness of what's happening in the ocean that I wondered, why can't we just, I wish someone would just sink these trawlers. It's just infuriating, especially when, a trawler would be, a pirate trawler would be, impounded and then auctioned off by the country that had impounded it, and the original owners would just buy it back and give it a new name, and it'd be out there doing exactly the same problem. And I know Indonesia have actually started sinking trawlers. Like when they capture them, they scuttle them. And so there are certainly some countries who are doing it. But yeah, it was a genuine frustration with and a discussion of the question, well, if the oceans are emptying, how much are we going to put human life ahead of that? And some people I know, they can't reach that. They can't get to that point. But once again, it's a fiction novel. It's a safe place to explore that idea without actually saying you have to do this or you haven't do this. It's just a discussion of basically how much are you prepared to do or what are you going to put ahead of yourself?
Well, when you first sent me this novel, one of the things you said in your note was there haven't been many reviews yet, but the ones that have appeared seem to struggle with the idea that humans might not be the most important animals on Earth. And I think that that's a hugely, even if the book wouldn't have been really good, I still would have loved you for that sentence. And I think that that's just the, and people ask me all the time, what do we need to do? And the first thing I always say is we need to make our loyalty with the natural world. And that, again, it's a really good book, but I could have forgiven the book a lot if I would have needed to, because of that, loyalty.
And it's something that, you know, it's a hard thing for a lot of people to accept. I mean, the putting humans at the center of every story, making humans the most important thing on the planet. And it's not something that I'm really that interested in. Through different readings, I've come across a German writer called Thomas Berry, and he talks about the Great Conversation and talks about how once stories used to involve the stories of the ocean and used to involve the stories of trees and used to, you know, and as we've become more and more, I hate to say modernized, but as we, you know, as cities have grown and as we've drifted further and further away from a life which engages with nature, we've sort of just written stories about ourselves. And so we have, you know, just books that are clearly just humans talking to humans all the time and not realizing that, you know, or not discussing the fact that, hey, we're actually part of a larger system. We're part of a larger environment. It's just always humans talking back to humans, and aren't our human stories the most fascinating stories that we could ever hear? And nothing's more important than our human stories. And it's sort of like, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not convinced. I'm just not convinced that that's the most important story. I'm not convinced that we're the most, you know, important creatures on the planet. I think we're a part of the planet. We might even be an essential part of the planet, but it's not the most important part. And bringing readers, maybe stepping them back away from that idea of superiority or supremacy. And I just think, I know your work has, you know, you've written on this subject as well. And it's lonely to achieve. It's lonely to reach that point. I think as, and after lifetimes of humans thinking themselves as the most intelligent, the most important, to actually step back from that and to face the fact that, you know, we're not that, is a lonely position to take. And yet the loneliness of modern life disappears when you realize that you're part of a greater system and that you're part of the environment. Not more important, less important, you're just part of it. And isn't that actually more comforting? I find that much more comforting. I find that much more reassuring to know that I'm part of the planet rather than this superior being that's got to be in control. Because as you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, is that anything we try and control, we mess up. So I like that idea of just sitting back, not really trying to be this grand dictator of the planet, and to just sort of be a participant of the planet maybe and respectful of everything else that's on it.
So I'm sorry if this is a too much of a technical writer question, but if you were talking to a young writer and you were going to give that young writer some advice as to how to write and to not have sort of a human supremacist attitude as you're writing, how do you, I mean, this is something I think about as I write all the time, is how do I, or how does anybody, when I'm reading somebody else's work, how do you make your characters a part of that larger whole? As a writer, what do you do to make it not specifically and solely human-centered? Because obviously, you know, the main characters are human.
Yeah.
But how do you do that as a writer? Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do, and it's a difficult question because the characters are human. The person who's reading the book is human. It's obviously a human exchange. So therefore, how do you communicate the idea that we're not the center of the story? And I guess as if I was giving advice to a younger writer, I'd say pay attention to the environment where you're in. Listen to the environment and listen to the stories that it might tell you. Listen to the perspective of the environment and try and pay attention, be sensitive to what it actually has to say. And you might find that you discover a wisdom or a story that you didn't expect before. There's no, for a young writer, I guess I'd say, there's no greater story to be told at the moment in that the planet is changing. We appear to be the cause of that problem. What greater story is there to be told? I mean, rather than just sitting in an echo chamber of human stories going back and forth, we've mined that resource quite completely. I'm not sure there's any more new human stories to tell. Maybe talk about, what place humans have in the environment or in the world and what it might look like, what we might do or how it might end up. It's an infinite sort of question, but I also think I can't really imagine a more important story to tell at the moment, which is how do we learn to live with the world without destroying it. I find I'm not really, even though there's a science fiction element to The Good Captain, I'm not really interested in stories of humanity taking off from the planet Earth and populating space. I find this not only highly improbable, but just ignorant. Just blatantly ignorant, because we already know that when astronauts go into space, their spine lengthens, their vision deteriorates, like retinas start loosening up, detaching. We know that it affects your genes, basically. When we go into space, we stop being human. So what this tells me is that we're intrinsically linked to this planet. Of course we are. We've never been anywhere else. When we go to the moon, Elon Musk goes to Mars, he can stay there. But they're going to take resources from the Earth. They're going to take water, or they're going to take metals or whatever. We're intrinsically linked to this planet. It's our life support system. And I know this sort of gets said quite often, but I don't think, people really take it into account. It's like they imagine that there's going to be somewhere else where we live, and yet there's been no example. And it's sort of like Carl Sagan saying, a small blue dot, where, everything we've achieved, every great human achievement, or, supposed great human achievement, everything that you can brag about being human occurred on this planet and because of this planet. And so then to not pay it the respect of providing that environment to destroy that environment, it seems ridiculous to think that we could then just trot off into space and go do it somewhere else. Well, where would we go? And like, what would we do to the next planet that we find? Do exactly the same thing. It's kind of, I find it, yeah, as you can probably tell, I'm a little bit, I'm not interested in entertaining that idea at all.
Well, it's absurd on many levels, all the ones you said. And also it just is, we're killing this planet. I mean, that's the bottom line of everything.
Yeah, and to what end? I mean, and I find this and I think as though to constantly be thinking about humans as the center of the as the main story that's occurring on this planet is, well, it's obviously egotistical, but it's also a way of distracting ourselves from the fact that, oh, no, surely we're too smart and we're too good to be doing that. But if you sort of accept it, if you accept that, we're responsible for it, then you can take a step back from that being that, you know, dominant creature and go, well, actually, yeah. And what are we going to do to stop it? If we're so clever, why are we doing it? If we're so superior, if we're so intelligent, why are we doing it? And these are questions that don't get asked. I think, you know, The Good Captain is about a future where fishermen just haven't stopped fishing. And I was having a discussion with a colleague and they were saying, well, you know, there's always going to be more fish in the sea. And it's like, well, we already have examples of that not being true. We already have examples of fishing grounds that have been fished out. We almost lost whales. We've certainly lost many species of whales. And there was an article in the Guardian just this week about narwhals. You know, their numbers are just plummeting, and they refer to them as the unicorns of the sea. And you know, the history of narwhals is that their long tusk, I think it is, used to be, you know, called a unicorn horn. But think about that. The unicorn of the sea, and it's disappearing. What other signal do we need to sort of say that things aren't going well and our current practices are not working? There was also another article in the Guardian recently about a salmon farm off New Zealand, and I've got no sympathy for salmon farms, but they're the world largest producer of Chinook salmons. And they've had to close down quite a few of their pens because they've had marine heat waves and the fish have just died en masse. And it was quite illuminating, the interview, because the CEO of the company says, well, we thought climate change was going to be maybe in, you know, a decade or two decades, but it's actually here. And I think that, yeah, they knew about climate change. They were just kicking it down the road while they made a bit of cash, not really caring about the effects of their whole industry. But then they've actually had to come to face the fact that actually, no, climate change is here and it's undermining their business and they've got to accept it. And then right at the very end of the article, they've put in a petition to the local government to access cooler waters. And you sort of just go, oh, yeah, I think I'll just go back to sinking trawlers. Thanks very much.
So when I write books, I am often thinking explicitly. I mean, I've said explicitly many times over the years that I am writing this for the coho salmon or for, you know, it's nice if people like what I'm saying now, but I'm really writing this who I really want the approval of. If I'm going to get any external approval, I want for the Delta smelt to be proud of me, or the black bears or whomever. Mm-hmm. And you said before that you're writing this, you know, in part for your son. Mm-hmm. And did you also consciously, as you're writing the book, were you having the same thought that I often have when I write of, you know, gosh, if tuna could read, I hope they would like this book. I think that sort of thing all the time.
No.
It's okay if you didn't. I really did.
I guess I just never. No, I didn't really put it in that context. Because I guess it gets back to the whole idea of, like, you know, I do think about the stories that animals tell each other. We tell our stories. We used to tell our stories verbally, and I'm sure animals tell their stories in many different ways. You have dogs. Anyone who's got a dog can see that dogs communicate, you know, not verbally, but other ways. And so there's multiple ways of communicating and therefore telling stories. So no, I guess I didn't think that the tuna would be happy with my book. I really just wanted to make something that I was proud of and that I could stand by, you know, if the future turns out to be the way we fear it might. And also, yeah, to just make my son proud of me, I suppose. it's, you know, what writing a book is like. It's always such a struggle to achieve or to realize your ambitions, and you always fall short. But there are parts of, you know, there's a, you know, I'm quite proud of the effort of, or the result of my effort, about 5 years of effort to get this book done and to get it published, which was, you know, it's a small market in Australia. Australia is only a country of 26 million people. And so we have a small publishing market. It's quite a conservative publishing market. It's a publishing market that once again sort of likes to tell particularly human stories, although there are some very fine writers here who are addressing environmental issues, such as Alexis Wright. The concerns of the business, or the business concerns of publishing, are quite predominant here. So I was very fortunate to find Transit Lounge Publishing, who published the book when pretty much no one else would publish it. And you know, they were very, very good to let me just let the book be. They didn't try and change it. They just understood it. They got it, and they were happy to publish it.
So before we started the interview, you asked me if we should do any spoilers on the book, and I said absolutely not. But now I've kind of changed my mind.
That's okay.
And it's not real spoiler, but it's a little bit of a spoiler, and that's you do something at the end that I really like, and also. Okay, so people who are going to read the book, this is not a real spoiler, but I love how, and I'm going to say this, and then if you can just take this any direction you want.
Okay.
I love how it's the ending is a new beginning. Do you know what I'm trying to get at?
Yep.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think I really like that, and that's also, well, just say whatever you want.
I wanted it to be a call to arms, I suppose. And so the crew are on a mission, and they complete that mission. And that mission, the completion of that mission, is really a signal that they're on a new level of descent. They're really aware of the danger of failing. They're really aware that their lives are at risk, and they're really aware that there's nothing left to lose. And so the book is about that moment where they sort of transform. The book is, there's a lot of characters in the book that undergo transformation, of personal transformation, reaching that point where they understand that this is who they are, this is what they're for, and now they've actually achieved and completed their mission, they can go on to keep on fulfilling that mission until someone stops them. Is that a reasonable assessment, Derek, without giving too much away?
Oh, no, it's great. That's great. Go ahead.
No. I was just, I guess, like I said, I wrote it with the ambition of inspiring people to do something, to draw a line in the sand, to make a decision, to become aware. I mean, the book was intended as a bit of a Trojan horse to tell an interesting story and surreptitiously encounter information that I thought is important, and I think is important, and to then, you know, close the book and go, well, where do I stand, and what am I going to do to try and prevent this?
You know, that this whole conversation, I've been thinking about a conversation I had back in the 90s with George Gerbner. And George Gerbner was the TV violence guy. He studied violence on TV. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people talk about X number of violent acts on TV, they're citing his work from the 50s through the 90s. Anyway, he said that most people actually misinterpret his work, and that his point is not that television is so violent, although he said certainly it creates what he called a mean world syndrome, in that, you know, most people go their entire lives without seeing very many murders. But, you know, if you watch TV, you see four of them in an evening.
Yeah.
And so you think the world's a lot scarier than it actually is. But he said that wasn't his main point. His main point was what he called casting and fate, which is, if you have a character who is a police officer, yeah, Bruce Willis is a police officer, he can kill seven people in the first 6 minutes of a movie, and you don't think anything of it because he's Bruce Willis. But if you have somebody who is in a different set of circumstances, they won't. And if they kill one person, the entire movie has to be about how they would do such a crazy thing. And so my point is, going back to the original topic about political novels, you know, it's like, it really is true that every novel is political. And if you have a World War II novel and the protagonists are U.S. soldiers and the bad guy, well, Saving Private Ryan, you know, how many Germans do they kill? And we don't think anything of it because it's just, those are the Germans and the Allies have to kill the Germans. And that's just expected. But now when you flip things on their head, so for example, early on in the book, you have this, I think, horrific description of all these creatures just being mangled and destroyed on the trawler. And that's just part of life. I mean, that just, you could put that in any book in the world, and that would just be most of the time. I mean, I remember reading a few years ago, who's the guy who did Arkady? There were the Russian, he's an American guy, but he wrote the Russian novels. One of them was about the Sable Farms. Oh God, it was really famous. Made into a movie with William Hurt. He's a good writer. Anyway, he has one of his movies is set on a trawler, and it's no big deal for them to be killing millions of fish because the fish are just background. But the point is, if you have somebody killing the people who's killing the millions of fish, suddenly you and I have to have an entire long, stupid discussion about how this is a political novel. Whereas if they're just killing fish, that's just a background for a spy novel. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I do. It's examining. I think that gets back to everything that we've been talking about, examining the position of humanity within the planet. Why is this? I don't think human life is not valuable. I just don't think it's more valuable than other life. Not at the expense of like whole species disappearing. I don't understand how that can't be a call for people to put down their personal priorities in favor of saving whole species. They're disappearing. And it's interesting. It's interesting as well how people feel about fish, because, you know, I've got a dog, you've got a dog, lots of people got a dog, you know, but if I see anything about, you know, a cruelty to a dog, I'm just so upset by it. But if you see, you know, someone hauling in a fish, there's not that sort of relationship. And it's because we have a close relationship with dogs. I'm not naive in regards to that. But no one would think it was art to, I should explain. There was a photographic award in Australia, and it was of this chef who has a fish restaurant, and he's famous for using the whole fish, and he's got this pose with a knife and this huge Mai Mai fish. And it's a beautiful photograph, sure, but I always think when I'm looking at this photo going, well, if you put a giraffe in there, would it be a work of art? Or if you put a kangaroo in there, would it be a work of art? I don't think so. But because it's a fish, that seems to be okay. And which is a strange way of thinking for me. I guess because they're removed, we don't, you know, they live in a different environment to us, and yet we know that, you know, we all came from the ocean. That's where life on this planet began. And yet we have this strangely removed relationship with the creatures in the ocean. Maybe it's their abundance that made us think that way, but we're certainly not suffering from abundance now. And to unlearn that type of attitude or unlearn that behavior is, yeah, maybe one of the objectives of my book.
So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and this is probably an unfair question, and you don't have to answer if you don't want. But are you thinking? Do you have more novels in mind?
Yeah, I do. I'm halfway through the next one, definitely the first draft at least. I feel as though the environment will always be a part of it. I can't sort of, like I've said before, I can't imagine there being a story that's more important. What shape it takes, what guise it unfolds in, I'm not sure. But I don't ever think that one. It's sort of like once you see the world a certain way, you can't unsee it. And once you see or listen to the stories that the planet can tell you, you can't unhear them. You can't go back to having just human conversations or telling just human stories. It just doesn't work like that. And I don't think I'd ever want to.
I want to go back to the fish thing for a second. The notion that fish, you know, various fish, it's, you know, for what it's worth, scientists have found that fish teach each other things. Fish remember, like if a fish encounters a predator somewhere, it knows to avoid that place for a long time. They have friends. They associate with some fish in their group and they don't associate with others. Mm-hmm. They're just it has always struck me, or has long struck me, that just because everybody says, I mean, the human supremacists say we should never anthropomorphize. But what they do is they project emptiness onto everybody else. And they're just, I don't understand why, just because their intelligence isn't like ours and just because their beingness isn't like ours, doesn't mean it's not worthy.
Exactly. And it's coming to that. It's reaching that equation of valuing something beyond yourself. And I think, you know, capitalism doesn't really encourage that. And once you do sort of, you know, arrive at that sort of acknowledgement, you know, the world becomes even more astounding, more interesting. And you don't feel as, like I said, you don't feel quite as lonely in the world, because no, I'm a part of the whole system, and everything has value. And if you have to, you know, as you've said, Derek, in your works, if you have to take something, you make sure that you give something back, or you take as little as you can. I feel as though the older I get, and the more I think about this, the only solution I feel to the problems that the planet is beset by is if humans actually just learn to have less. And it's simple, but it's really it's a simple message, and yet it's a really difficult one to accept, just having less.
I have two questions left. One of them is there anything that you've wanted to say about the book or about the oceans that you were hoping you'd get to say in this interview, but I haven't given you the chance?
No. I mean, I'm always astounded by this one fact. You know, 100 million sharks killed every year. The sharks have been around since before the dinosaurs, 450 million years. And they survived, you know, the extinction of the dinosaurs. And they're still here. And yet at this point in, you know, their existence, they're going extinct. If that's not an example of like a system that is destructive and broken and needs to be corrected, then I can't really understand what is. I mean, a species that resilient can, and we can sort of destroy it. I find that most convincing evidence. And your second question, Jared?
So how do people find out more about your work? How do people, both in Australia and also the rest of the world, get a hold of this book or find out more about any of your books?
They can visit my website at seanraben.com. And I think the books are available at online retailers, or they could buy them directly from my publisher, Transit Lounge. And I'm sure, yeah, it's available. I hope you enjoy it.
Well, so what I would like for you to do is hurry up and finish that next book so that I can read it and then interview you again.
Derek, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Sean Rabin. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.